are tricky things. Anyone who's ever sat down to write knows this, whether it be a poem or a story or an essay that's due tomorrow or a letter where you really must say things properly, or instead of the healing you're trying to bring about, you'll bring about the opposite. Or if you were to sit down to write a gospel, you can imagine how tricky it would be to begin. In our Bibles, we have four gospels, of course, four different books devoted to telling, really, the same story. The good news, hence the word gospel, that Jesus is the Messiah. But each gospel writer chose to begin in a very different way. Listen to these beginnings. From Mark. The beginning of the good news about Jesus Christ, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet. I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way. He's quoting Isaiah here. And again, a voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight paths for him. And so John the Baptist appeared in the wilderness, preaching a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. The whole Judean countryside and all the people of Jerusalem went out to him. Confessing their sins, they were baptized by him in the Jordan River. John wore clothing made of camel's hair with a leather belt around his waist, and he ate locusts and wild honey. We might think of this as the Hollywood gospel. There's a brief nod to history to give sort of a sense of depth, and then we go right to hyperbole and special effects. Or from Luke, the beginning of Luke. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. In the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah, and it goes on. Zechariah goes in, sees an angel, doesn't believe him, can't talk. We know the rest. We could think of this as the documentary gospel. Right off the bat, it's trying to establish its good research credentials. And now John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Again, a very different sense here in this beginning. Think of this as the theology gospel. It's heavy in theology right off the bat. And now Matthew. Here's how Matthew begins. This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, I've only read through one third of this genealogy. And it ends with Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. We might categorize this as the nightmare, endless family history slideshow gospel. As a beginning, you must admit, this feels rather weak. So an obvious question for Matthew is, why? Why start like this? And also, we should ask, why all these women? Because for a Hebrew genealogy to include women was very uncommon. This should catch our attention if we know anything about what we're reading. And to include four women in such a short little space, in the first third of the genealogy there appear these four women, all basically leading up to or involving King David. This is extraordinary. So we must ask why. And the reason why we must ask why of this gospel writer is this. Imagine if I were to set you down at a very large table with a big stack of index cards, and on each index card was a little parable that Jesus told, a little story about his life, some kind of teaching. Everything is there in this stack, and your job is to spread these index cards all out and put them together in an order that makes sense, that tells the story of the good news of Jesus Christ. How would you do it? Most likely you'd start with the youngish stuff and you'd end with the death, resurrection, and ascension. But in the middle, when the chronology is not obvious, how would you arrange things? Chances are you spend a long time looking at index cards all over your table until you started to see some themes emerging, and you'd put the cards together that went with certain themes, and then you'd try to put those themes together in such an order that your reader gets to know Jesus, gets to know something about Jesus. This is what the gospel writers had to do. They had lots of stories. They had to put them together in such a way that their readers would learn about Jesus. And in order to read any passage in a gospel in all of its richness, we need to ask ourselves not only what is Jesus teaching if it's a story about Jesus, we need to ask ourselves, what is the gospel writer trying to show us? Why this story now? So, a beginning with Matthew in general. To get to know Matthew in general. Matthew, and I'm putting that in quotation marks because he may or may not have been the Matthew who was the tax collector, was probably a Greek-speaking Jew living in the 70s, and that's not 30 years ago, I mean the real 70s, putting together his gospel for a church which was, at that time, filled with both Jews and Gentiles. When Matthew sat down to compile this gospel, the Jewish temple had only just recently been destroyed by the Romans. As a result, there had been a serious backlash by Jews against Gentiles, as you can imagine. What had been a more open-minded, pluralistic kind of Judaism was being rapidly replaced by a Judaism obsessed in an unhealthy way with religious purity. And the church, the Christian church, was part of these struggles. For instance, we know that in the year 85, there appeared in Jewish literature a curse on all heretics, including and especially those who believed Jesus to be the Messiah. So, come back to Matthew and his task, sitting at the table with a bunch of index cards, putting together a gospel for a church filled with both Jews and Gentiles in this time of very high tension. Throughout his gospel, Matthew seems to want to show two things. Yes, Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the fulfillment of Jewish longing. But this fulfillment moves beyond the confines of Judaism. Matthew, for instance, is the only gospel to record the Magi, Gentiles who worshiped Jesus, the King of the Jews. And Matthew ends his gospel with the Great Commission. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. Well, that's very nice, Paul, but what does this have to do with the women in Matthew's genealogy? Well, it's going to take us 4 weeks to answer that question, but here's a preliminary proposal. In mentioning these four women, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba, Matthew is reminding his readers, especially any of his Jewish readers tempted by the trend toward purity, that the history of the Jewish people is not as pure as they might like to think. Three of these four women are Gentiles, and yet they are all ancestors of King David, who is a man after God's own heart. And the fourth woman may not be a Gentile, but she was the wife of one. She was the wife of a Hittite, and that's a people group the Israelites were supposed to have removed from the Promised Land. And this fourth woman was the mother of Solomon, who presided over the building of the first temple and arguably the best days of any Israelite kingdom. So in other words, Matthew is saying, by including these four women, so-called outsiders, and remember that a Gentile woman would be a double outsider in the Jewish male-dominated culture, so-called outsiders have always been part of the story of God's people. And not only do Matthew's Jewish readers need to hear this, but so also do Matthew's Gentile readers, who especially need to hear that they are included in the great story of God's love for humanity. Now, in the season of Advent, it's traditional to focus on the coming of the Messiah, on why we need a Messiah, to focus on what it feels like to need and to wait for the Messiah. And that's why the decoration in the church has changed. It's minimal. It's supposed to be a feeling of waiting, like Mary waiting for a child, like being in darkness and waiting for light, of hoping for the time when we can say, along with Mary, "He has brought down the proud and lifted the humble." This week's focus, then, will be on the Tamar story, or more accurately, the Judah and Tamar story. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the Judah and Tamar story, there's a good reason for that. It's almost always completely skipped in Sunday school. For two reasons. The story is inappropriate for children, especially young children. And with that in mind, let me just say that I have altered the reading just a bit so that those who have ears to hear can hear, and those who are coloring can't. But if any words come up and you know, parents get asked about these words at home, I apologize, but isn't it good that we can have these discussions from a Bible reading instead of a television program? The second reason that you may not be familiar, and the reason that this story is skipped in Sunday school, is that while the story occurs within the context of what we've always thought of as the Joseph story, this one chapter in Genesis doesn't seem to really have anything to do with the Joseph story, so we skip it, figuring nothing got lost. But as adults, we need to ask ourselves, an entire chapter devoted to something that isn't part of the story, devoted to an interruption, that's usually a sign that we don't really know what it is that we're reading. That interruption probably isn't one. And that means we need to rethink what that section of Genesis, chapters 37 to 50, really is. Maybe it's more than simply the Joseph story, as we've always thought. And so here this morning, I'm going to argue that the Joseph story isn't. That it's really the Judah story. I'm going to overstate my case, because Joseph has gotten all the press. So I understand that I'm overstating my case. I just want you to know that now. But listen to my argument. Joseph's character does not change very much. He's annoyingly good at the beginning. He's annoyingly good at the end. But Judah's character changes lots. Joseph's status doesn't change very much. He's the favorite, and then he's the favorite, and then the favorite, and then the favorite. But Judah's status does change. He goes from being the fourth-born son to, by the end, being the head son. So think of Joseph as a tall mountain, a towering figure. He affects all those around. He is the prominent feature on the landscape. But like a mountain, Joseph is relatively static. Think, we wouldn't read a story of someone canoeing from France to Newfoundland and call it the Atlantic Ocean story. Imagine a group of paraplegics overcoming all odds to climb the world's highest mountain and call it the Mount Everest story. And so also, I argue this morning, we shouldn't mistake the setting with the story in the last quarter of Genesis. I think Joseph is more a part of the setting. Think of him as Mount Goodness. Or Mount Annoying Goodness, if you're willing to risk heresy. And I think the character of Judah is where the action really is in the story. And I'm going to try to make that case this morning. And I warn you, as I've already said, there are bodies ahead. It's actually encouraging to know that the Bible isn't nearly as squeamish about our sexuality as we are. Now, you know the so-called Joseph story. Favorite son, nice coat, sold into slavery. At the end, he saves everybody. He saves Egypt. He saves all of the neighboring countries. He saves his family. We'll read part of that story this morning, the parts which constitute what I'm calling the Judah story. But first, some background information about this family. Judah's father, Jacob, married two sisters. Never a particularly wise thing to do. He didn't mean to, you know, in his defense. But he did, and they competed for Jacob's love by trying to have lots of children, which involved using their maid servants as surrogate child bearers. One is reminded of this, the little puppet wars that occurred during the Cold War, where you really knew on one side was the U.S. and on the other side was the Soviet Union, but it, on the surface, it looked like two other countries were fighting. This is, they brought in their maid servants. You have babies too, and there was this great competition. Judah was the fourth-born son, as I've said. Eventually, he comes to be considered the head son. Why is this? Well, because the first-born son and the second and the third all did horrible things that sort of disqualified them from any kind of decent leadership. Reuben, the oldest, took advantage of his first-born status. He used the power he already had as firstborn to try to grab for more power in an inappropriate way. It involved his father's concubine. You can connect those dots. Jacob found out and was disgusted. And it turns out if you read the story, and this is a real, I had a real hard time cutting this out, but I had to read those last 14 chapters of Genesis and see that Reuben is a buffoon. No one listens to Reuben. He talks and talks. He tries to assert leadership. Reuben is the only one listening to Reuben, as it turns out. Unless someone listens long enough to say no. The next two, Simeon and Levi, along with their brothers, convinced an entire city's worth of men to get circumcised. And then Simeon and Levi, while those men are recovering, went into the city and attacked and killed them all. The men were in pain, they were helpless, they could not run, obviously. And when Simeon and Levi were confronted with this, saying, you can't do this, this is awful, they were completely unrepentant. Yeah, well, they shouldn't have done that. What made us mad, they shouldn't have done. So we did it. This is just a brief introduction to a seriously messy and dysfunctional family. I hope that you can feel that. With that messiness in the background, let's read the Judah story. I'd like you to listen as Judah moves from being brutally calloused at the beginning to what we would call Christ-like by the end. And listen for the crucial role that Tamar plays in this character's development. So, Joseph is sent to check up on his brothers. They throw him in a well. They're deciding what to do when Judah says, Judah, our hero, to his brothers, what will we gain? Literally, it's what's the profit? What's the take? What's in it for us if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites instead and not lay our hands on him. After all, now suddenly appealing to some kind of sense of morality, after all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. So, yeah, right? So in the midst of arguing that we should sell him and make money rather than killing him, which doesn't make us any money, suddenly he switches gears and says, he's our brother after all. His brothers agreed. So Joseph heads off to Egypt and to Potiphar, as we know, and the brothers head back home with a richly ornamented robe that's now soaked in goat's blood. Now, here comes the chapter that's always skipped in Sunday school, which is, you know, can you imagine the flannel graphs? But I'm reading this, I'm going to read this chapter in its entirety because this is the story that Matthew is reminding us about when he mentions Tamar in the genealogy. This is what Matthew has in mind and what he wants to put into his readers' minds when he starts off his gospel with a reference to Tamar. At that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hirah. There, Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man. He married her and lay with her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was at Kazib that she gave birth to him. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to produce offspring for your brother. A note here, if your brother died without having children and you were his brother, you were obligated to impregnate his widow, and those children would not legally be considered yours, they would legally be considered your brother's. It would keep the family line going. It also acted as a kind of a safety net, a social safety net for the widow, because now she would have children who could take care of her in her old age, you see. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he lay with his brother's wife, he spilled his seed on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. I remember as a child always wondering, isn't that what you do with seeds? Why is that bad? And in the Hebrew, evidently, the meaning is that he did this repeatedly, which is bad in two ways. He's repeatedly disobeying what he ought to be doing as a duty for her and for the memory of his brother. So he's repeatedly disobeying, but it also means that repeatedly he's using her. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so he put him to death also. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, live as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. This, by the way, puts her on hold in her life. If she's living as a widow, she's unavailable and she's waiting for this youngest son to grow up. But Judah was thinking he might die too, just like his brothers. Everyone who sleeps with her dies. I've only got one son left. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. After a long time, Judah's wife died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah, to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend, Hirah, the Adullamite, went with him. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that although Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. She realized she had been abandoned. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she'd covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, come now, let me sleep with you. "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll send you a young goat from my flock." "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" "What pledge should I give you?" "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand," she answered, which is a kind of ancient Near Eastern equivalent of saying, "I'd like all your major credit cards, please." Identification, that's what they were. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but the friend could not find her. He asked the men who lived there, "Where's the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Enaim?" "There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here," they said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her. Besides, the men who live there say, there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep what she has then, or we'll become a laughingstock. After all, I did try to send her this young goat, but you couldn't find her." You can almost hear him rationalize, "Right? Right? Right. Okay, just leave it then." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law, Tamar, is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, just in case he's going to miss this, "See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." At this point, in the Hebrew, it'd be much more obvious to notice, but we still can in the English translation. Notice the parallel to the previous chapter, where the sons go back to Jacob and say, "See if you recognize this coat that's covered in blood." It's the exact same word, hakarna, I think it is, in Hebrew. Recognize. Do you recognize this? And again, this is more evidence that this chapter we always want to skip is not an interruption, but is part of the flow. Anyway, Judah recognized them and said, and this is the moment here, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. And as she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand. So the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it on his wrist and said, "This one came out first." But when he drew back his hand, his brother came out. And she said, "So this is how you have broken out." This is just a midwife talking to all these babies appearing and disappearing. And the one who came out first was named Perez, which means breaking out. And then his brother, who had the scarlet thread, came out, and he was given the name Zerah, which means scarlet. Now notice, Judah has moved from a very calculated, "What's in it for us? Why kill when we can sell?" to an offhanded, "Have her burned to death." Considering what he had just done on the side of the road with a prostitute, "Have her burned to death." To a truly repentant, "She is more righteous than I." Which is an obvious contrast to Simeon and Levi when they were asked, "Why did you kill all these people?" "Well, they shouldn't have done that." Now, we have to fast forward through the better known parts of this story. And again, what most people miss is Reuben's fall from Head's son. I encourage you to read it. It is very entertaining. Read it aloud with Reuben as a whiny, impotent leader. At the end, Joseph's brothers, who are now in the text, very interestingly, called Judah and his brothers. That's what Jacob's sons are now called, Judah and his brothers. Judah has assumed a position of leadership. They have to go to Egypt twice to buy food, and on the second time, Joseph arranges for Benjamin to be falsely accused. And Joseph says, "I'll be merciful, let you all go back. I'll just keep Benjamin here." And here it comes, the climax of the Judah story. This is the most important speech in Judah's life. After explaining to this man, the second in command under Pharaoh, all about his father and how his father's already lost a son, a favorite son in the past, and now this would be another favorite son. And by the way, Joseph and Benjamin are the two favorite sons because they're the only two from Rachel, who was Jacob's only real true love. Judah says this, "So now, if Benjamin isn't with us when I go back to my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with this boy's life, if he sees that the boy isn't there, my father will die. We will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. I guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I don't bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please let me remain here as your slave in place of the boy. And let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy isn't with me? No. Do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father." So it is Judah at the beginning who sells Joseph into slavery, and it is Judah at the end who volunteers to be a slave. Look how far he's come. From sell him to burn her to I was wrong to now. Even though he is the head son, he says, imprison me. And only now is it possible for the climax of the Joseph story. He declares himself, look, I'm Joseph, to his brothers, and they don't believe him at first, but then they finally do believe him. Then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept, and Benjamin embraced him weeping. And he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. Afterward, his brothers talked with him. Then Joseph sent his brothers away, back to go get daddy. And as they were leaving, he said to them, don't quarrel on the way. So I hope that makes my point about Mount Annoying Goodness. Jacob's entire household does move to Egypt, and then Jacob does finally die, as if you read the text, he's been promising to do for years. And when Jacob dies, he has blessings and curses for his sons. Then Jacob called for his sons and said, gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. And the first thing that happens is Reuben, the firstborn, who had the inappropriate grasp for power with his father's concubine, Reuben gets cursed. Quote, for you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it. Next come Simeon and Levi. They also get cursed. For they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Next comes Judah. Judah, your brothers will praise you, which is a little bit of a joke because Judah sounds like praise. So it's kind of like, praise, your brothers will praise you. Or Judah, your brothers will Judah you. It's a pun. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons, let's just translate that, your brothers, okay, will bow down to you. Who are they bowing down to at the beginning of this story? Joseph has a dream that they're all going to bow down to him, right? And they do, of course, in Egypt, till they know who he is. But at the end, it's Judah who is told, your brothers will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? And now listen to this. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. Now, Joseph gets a massive blessing, too, of course, but interestingly, unlike the blessing of Judah, for Joseph there is no mention of any bowing down, and there is no indication of future royalty. All of that is for Judah. And just as a matter of trivia, the religion is called Judaism. And that's from Judah. Jerusalem is the capital city in the kingdom of Judah. We call these people Jews. This is where the glory and the honor is for the future of this people. And of course, for us, we can look forward to Revelation, in which Jesus himself is called the Lion of Judah. And from that blessing, we can see why. So, to conclude, listen again. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. There is so much in those lines. But, you ask, this sermon is supposed to be about Tamar. Why have you been talking about Judah all this time? I knew we shouldn't have let a man preach about women. Ah, I reply. And as you can see, I have miraculously anticipated your question. I never promised you a sermon on Tamar. Rather, we are investigating the story or stories that her name brings to mind in the Jewish reader of Matthew's time. Remember that we are investigating this question. Matthew, what are you up to, starting with a genealogy like this? And clearly, with the mention of Tamar, what we see coming to mind once we immerse ourselves in the stories again is the story of Judah, a man in desperate need of hope and transformation. And what did it take to bring Judah's transformation into effect? It took a woman with more courage than he had. Whatever else you might want to say about Tamar, and it is very entertaining to read the commentaries about Tamar, how she is either glorified as the only one who really was thinking about the future of the Jewish people, as if she had all this in mind. And on the other hand, she's written off as a completely vile woman, and it just kind of lucked out that things turned out. But the truth is obviously somewhere in the middle. She was a completely oppressed person. She was discarded as so much embarrassing trash. And she did all that's available to people like that. She had audacity. She had courage and a liberal heap of deception. That's all that's available to oppressed people. She had more courage than he had. In a very forceful way, Tamar brought Judah face to face with his own sinfulness, with his betrayal of her, with his deceit, with his quite obvious double standard concerning sexual morality. The transformation of Judah's character, to repeat, can be summed up in these words: she is more righteous than I. And in the transformed character of Judah, we see what a truly godlike treatment of power is. By contrast, Reuben used his status power to grab for more status. Simeon and Levi used their physical power to fight for more strength. But Judah used his power of leadership to say, "Please let me remain here as your slave." But looking back, we, along with the first readers of Matthew's gospel, can also see that it wasn't only Judah, the person, who found hope and transformation. In this story, Judah, the kingdom, was also on the line. We lit the first Advent candle this morning, the candle of hope. In Matthew's genealogy, the presence of Tamar is a powerful reminder that hope and transformation can, and often do, perhaps must, come from unconventional sources. In Judah's case, the transformation came from what he once considered a Gentile castaway of a woman. We all have messiness and dysfunctionality in our lives. Seeing how God worked through the messiness of Judah's family should give us hope. Let us remember then, as we look upon this candle, there is hope for us in the midst of our messiness. Through Tamar, Matthew has reminded us, God is full of surprises. In this season of Advent, we are called to wait and to see that the Lord is good. Let us wait with hope.